Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we are back with a great episode for you, very timely for what's been going on in the news this past week. And before we get into all of that, I will go ahead and cut over to my co-host, Sam Bradley, who has been part of our active discussion over in our Facebook group about the recent rescue in Thailand with the soccer team and the cave rescue there, the diving, just the whole nine yards. Has been a very active series of discussions. And if you've been checking out our Facebook group over there, you'll know all about that. But Sam, we decided to kind of push back another topic and cover that this week. And there's a lot going on.
Oh, yeah. And we have more to come. I'm going to talk to Kyle about another topic here in a bit. But we scored big tonight with the guy that's actually been kind of the media representative as a diver for what's going on there. And like you said, the story is very fresh, so I'm glad we could get it out this week. But first, I have to harass the weather guy, Kyle Nelson. Will you cool it off, please? What's up with that?
Well, Sam, good evening and good evening to everyone out there on the Disaster Podcast. Yes, it is definitely warm here over southwest the United States and Colorado especially. I was rolling through on this morning, actually flying back from a teaching assignment. And yeah, I step off the plane at 11 in the morning in Denver, and it's like 96 degrees. It was incredible. But it's not the heat that we're going to be talking about so much. It's the rainfall that's in the forecast. And we'll talk about how that all plays in here in just a little bit. Looking back across the last week of weather across the U.S., lots of large hail, but mostly damaging winds all the way from the northern plains through the southeast over the past week. On the tropical side of things, looking off in the Atlantic Basin, Hurricane Beryl thankfully was short-lived, producing heavy rain and winds over the Leeward and Windward Islands last week, but it quickly dissipated just after reaching hurricane strength. We have our third named system now in the Atlantic, Hurricane Chris sitting off the North Carolina coast and causing high surf and rip currents there in those coastal areas of North Carolina and the Virginias, but it's forecasted to slowly move northeast and stay out at sea, thankfully. However, Beryl might be back as the remnants of it continues to drift north and west. It might actually redevelop, and the National Hurricane Center is watching that, and the hurricane hunters will be flying missions starting tomorrow. Looking at things on the wildfire side, there are currently 72 named wildfires nationally, having consumed over 1 million acres, including one that is just that they stopped at about half a mile from my house here in Colorado, the Lake Christine fire. So it got right up close and personal and much too close for my liking. Looking forward now, excessive heat in the Pacific Northwest and heavy rain across the southwest United States. And that's a big concern for us because any burn scar areas, so areas that have been burned or affected by wildfire, the rain and the precipitation that falls, it doesn't go in and become groundwater. It hits that that surface that's been burned. It doesn't soak in and it runs off and can cause flash flooding, landslides, mudslides. So we go right from one extreme to the other, hoping it doesn't get too much worse. But that's a quick update on the disaster weather world.
And actually,
Sam,
speaking of landslides and mudslides, we can't forget what happened in Japan this past week in the midst of everything else that was going on around the world. Japan really got slammed by some repeated rainstorms that caused severe flooding and mudslides and landslides over there, I see.
Yes, absolutely they did. And this is just the start of kind of the monsoon season there in Southeast Asia. So this is if this is a hint at what's to come, it could be a very, very active season on the response side for those local authorities there. But yes, many, many reports of heavy rains and mudslides in Japan. Anywhere, I haven't found any official numbers just yet, but right now I'm seeing over 100 fatalities with likely more to be discovered as things go on and as the rescue efforts continue to go. And now with the infrastructure damage on top of that, makes it even more and more difficult to make an effective response and to help coordinate things now following these widespread rain and flood events in Japan.
Yeah, in fact, Kyle, Jamie had posted an idea that I like, and I'm hoping maybe you and Becky can put something together about all of that, and the monsoon period and what happens and what's likely to come. And, you know, as you get more Japan, it would be good to present, because that's going to be an ongoing story for a while as well.
Absolutely, it will. But more to follow on that. But I'm really interested, Sam. And as you hinted at to start us off this this afternoon, we have a great episode here, and we're going to focus on the response side of things.
Exactly. Speaking of the monsoon, that's a good segue, because it certainly factors into our story tonight. But we also have Dr. Joe with us. Hi, Joe.
How are things in Memphis? Hi, Sam. Hello, everybody.
Things are fine here. Spotty springtime showers as usual, and hot and muggy.
Joe, I think it's summer.
It is. It's summer here, so.
Of course, it's always hot in the South. But we have our friend Kevin Ryder with us tonight from Wild Medicine. He was a former dive rescue medic and all kinds of other things. So when I thought of him, when I thought of this topic, and he has a good friend who has been really kind of the media person involved on the dive side of this story. So clearly we're going to be talking about the kids, the soccer players in Thailand. And I'm just going to go nuts here, because I have so much interesting information and questions, and I know everybody else. So say hi, Kevin.
Hi, Kevin. I know where my mute button is.
Hey, Kevin, why don't you go ahead and introduce our guest and bring him into the conversation?
Sure. So I met Bob Wilson back in, it had to be probably 2002 or 2003, I think. I took a number of dive specialty courses when I moved back to New Jersey after getting out of the military, and Bob wound up being my dive master instructor. And just because turnabout is fair play, I was one of Bob's EMT instructors a few years after that. But Bob, I'm not even going to begin to even try and introduce Bob. His resume is about 5 miles long. And he's, if there's a cave diver extraordinaire, it's Bob. So I'll let Bob take off with his own story. And so, Bob, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you, and thank you for that lofty introduction.
Anytime. So fill us in a little bit about your diving career, I guess it would be.
Sure. I've been diving for a little over 30 years, I suspect. I've been an instructor since 1992, and for about the last, 18 years now, I'm affiliated with a dive training organization known as PADI, which stands for the Professional Association of Diving Instructors. And I have the title of course director, which is really an instructor trainer. Also, you know, caving has certainly entered into the picture. I've been cave diving for about 18 years, I suppose. And I also got involved early on in what has become known as technical diving, which is the deeper, longer dives that people have been participating in. And I was fortunate, you know, timing's everything with so many things in life. And I was fortunate to just get involved with this at a period in time where a lot of these skills, techniques, and methodologies were really emerging, and hooked up with a very good group of people that were like-minded in their pursuit of this technical diving. And a lot of the skills that are commonplace now are really cutting-edge stuff back then. And it was a very privileged time in diving to participate in a lot of these skills. So it's I've been fortunate in my diving career. I've met a lot of good people. I've moved up the ladder, so to speak, and really enjoyed the journey. It's been a good run.
So, Bob, what are some of the more technical accomplishments, I should say? You were one of the early... Well, you wrote the book on advanced wreck diving. You left that part out. And I know you have a number of other firsts in the industry. Can you expand on those a little bit?
Well, yeah, I did write a course that was accepted by PADI, that organization I spoke about earlier, which was advanced wreck diving. At the time I wrote it, which was, it was way back in 95, I think, 1995, no other agency really had a course like that. And it was an interesting time in that you kind of went from very recreationally based diving to very advanced type diving. And the transition was very rapid. It was a very steep learning curve. So I kind of perceived the need for a course like that, an advanced rec diving course. And I put it together, and it was a great learning experience to do. It's been a lot of fun to teach it. It's been received pretty well. Since then, since 1995, some other agencies have come out with their own version of that. It was mine was, I suppose, one of the first ones out there. Kind of proud of it, of course. It was a good experience to write. As far as diving, we started out, again, you know, exploring a lot of the dives that have become known as technical diving. And of particular note, I mean, certainly back then, in the early, let's say, late 90s, early 2000, even late 80s, really, let me go back a little further, there, we started diving a shipwreck known as the Andrea Doria, which some of you may be familiar with. It was an Italian passenger liner that sunk, I believe, in 1956 off the coast of New York, Nantucket, in that area, about 100 miles out. And that's about 250 feet down. And that was, that back then, it was quite an accomplishment. Now, as a result of increased technology and experience and a whole lot of things, trial and error on a lot of people's part, they pushed the envelope even further to, like, you know, 250 feet used to be like dives extraordinaire. And it certainly still is. I'm not trying to minimize it. But it has advanced way beyond that. And people were doing, you know, much more significant dives with respect to depth now. But back then, that was pretty wild. And in order to facilitate dives of that nature, you're no longer breathing air. You can, but there are certain physiological responses to going that deep on air which are not in your best interest to pursue. So what we learned is that by supplementing some of the, because air is basically a binary gas. It's oxygen, it's nitrogen with some trace gases. And what we did was we started to supplement some of the nitrogen with a gas known as helium. And the reason that was done is because the nitrogen in the air that you breathe can become narcotic as you go deeper. And you get what's commonly known as nitrogen narcosis. And it affects people in very different ways. Some people get giddy. Some people get terrorized. But it's not the type of thing you want to experience. And if you can eliminate it by the addition of helium, that certainly is to your advantage. You can, you know, no one really dies of nitrogen narcosis. But what happens is if a problem should present itself, you will not respond appropriately to that problem, which could lead to obviously very serious consequences. So the clearer your head can be with respect to the elimination of nitrogen narcosis, the better off you are with deep diving. So instead of that traditional binary gas, which air is, it's just oxygen nitrogen, you're now breathing a gas known as trimix. There's three gases. There's oxygen, nitrogen, and now the addition of helium. And so that was pioneering back then, and that opened up the door to a lot of the deep wrecks that were really unattainable on air. You could do them on air, but it really became very unsafe. So this opened the door to a lot of dive exploration.
And weren't you one of the early adopters of trimix diving, Bob?
Well, I certainly didn't invent it, but in my primary area of diving at the time, and probably still, is Northeast United States. And within that area, I guess we were one of the early people. I was in a group of the early people that really adopted using trimix. There was actually a fellow, I'll give him a plug, down in Key West. His name was Billy Deans. Is Billy Deans, and he was, to my knowledge, the first person to actually teach the use of trimix. So I sought him out in the early 90s, and pardon me, I took a course with him, and I was really one of the first small group of people to do that with him. And it, as I said, you know, it really opened the door to exploring a lot of the deep shipwrecks throughout the world, you know, particularly in my region in Northeast United States. So it was a great experience. I mean, it was a privilege, really, at that time. And it was unusual because a lot of people at the time, there's another gas, you know, I don't want to get overly technical with this, but there's another gas used for diving called enriched air nitrox, which is basically still a binary gas of oxygen and nitrogen, but the oxygen levels are increased, and it has certain physiological benefits with respect to diving and decompression. And back then, in the early 90s, people barely understood what enriched air nitrox was, let alone Trimix. So when I showed up with this, you know, Trimix stuff, they were, like, scratching their heads, like, what on earth is this stuff here? This is weird. And, pardon me, I have a tickle here. If you've ever breathed in, like, a party balloon, you know what helium can do to someone's voice. It gives you a kind of a Donald Duck-like effect. So you breathe that type of thing on the boat to test your mix before you jump in the water, and people are like, "My God, what on earth are you breathing?" So it was a pretty intense period in diving back then. It was again, it was a lot of good timing on my part, and right place, the right time, the right people, and it all kind of came together in a very good way.
Now, when did you start your cave diving?
I'm going to guess around 1999, 2000, somewhere around there. And primarily, I experienced the caves in the Yucatan Peninsula of Mexico, which are pretty amazing. There were caves that formed in an air environment, so they have a lot of what people traditionally think of the interiors of caves, of stalactites, stalagmites. I always think of that old movie, Journey to the Center of the Earth. And you see things like that. It was very good. And I say that in opposition to the caves you would find in, say, Florida, which are solution caves, which were formed in, it's called a karst topography, which is basically a limestone configuration, which is most of what Florida is. And they're solution caves. So as water infiltrates into the limestone, they create caves in that way, which are different than the caves in the Yucatan. They're not, well, I don't know. I guess beauty's in the eyes of the beholder, but I think the caves in Mexico, I think, visually are more stunning, not to take anything away from Florida cave divers, but it's just a matter of individual preference. But probably, you know, just that was the long answer to when did I start cave diving, which was approximately 1999 or 2000, I would think.
Wow, that's a lot of stuff. I've been harassing Kevin on the side here. He'd love to have you talk about everything you've ever done, but you're amazing. I mean, most of the stuff you're talking about, I've certainly never even heard of, and I'm a diver, so I'm pretty impressed. But I have to ask you one more question in relation to your experience. How did you end up being a media person on this story? How did they approach you?
Well, initially, I don't know if we're referring to the same thing, but a few days ago, I was approached by CBS News to do an interview regarding this situation over in Thailand. And that was kind of fortuitous with that. One of the people that was an employee of CBS News was a past student of mine as well. So when the topic came up and they were seeking someone that could make some contributions to their story, this fella apparently mentioned me to one of his producers, who then called me. And that's how I ended up with that. I'm assuming that's what you were referring to. If I didn't answer your question,
yeah. Kevin sent us a video of one of the interviews you did, and he said you've been involved in a few others. But I'm going to tell you what little I know about the story, and I'm sure you know more about it, so you can add to that, and anybody else that wants to jump in. But for those of you that have been living in a cave, or maybe that's a bad way to put this, but the 12 boys and their coach, after a soccer game, decided to explore this cave, but then a monsoon came in, so that cut off their escape, and it also prevented rescuers from finding them. It took 10 days just to find where they were. And they had to go through dark and tight passageways filled with muddy water and strong currents. and they were faced with oxygen depleted air. So that's kind of the scenario as I understand it. You want to expand on that? Or Kevin, you can too as well.
Bob, go ahead.
Oh, sure. That's pretty much my understanding as well. The cave was apparently a up until the monsoon, of course, was a dry cave. You know, it formed in a dry environment, and they went in to do their exploration, which I'm in no position to judge that decision, good or bad, but that was their choice at the time. And the cave, as I understand it, extended in about or approximately 2.5 miles. Now, that's not to say it's 2.5 miles deep in a horizontal sense, but it's apparently 2.5 miles in more of a vertical sense. So it's they went in, and like most natural formations, it's not perfectly flat or level. And they had to transition some very narrow areas that cave divers call restrictions. And they had to go up and down some very narrow channels, some of which I believe there was a restriction that was as small as 15 inches wide. And if you're not wearing any kind of scuba gear or anything like that, that's still kind of a snug squeeze, but it's something that's doable. And they went in there 2.5 miles, and I guess when it came time to turn around, they noticed that things got a little wet, and it just blocked their way out. And it's absolutely an amazing story. I mean, just absolutely astonishing that they were located, first of all, and that they're all healthy and well in a relative sense. So, go ahead, sorry.
That is one of my questions. How did they survive for 10 days? Did they have food? Did they have water? I don't think they clearly intended to be stuck there.
I haven't heard anything. I haven't heard much about that. I mean, I think they had some limited snacky kind of things with them that they happened to be carrying in with them. But they really didn't. They didn't have anything to live off of. And they were in a trapped, enclosed space with just the air that was trapped in there with them, and very little food, if any, for at least 10 days. Yeah, and that's my understanding. Is that correct to what you understand as well, Bob?
It is. Clearly, the immediate concerns are malnutrition, dehydration, maybe even more important. And the fact that they were apparently in a air chamber or dome, and I don't know what the dimensions were there at all. It appeared just from the videos that I saw, it was very small. The other concern, after 10 days or so, and again, it depends on the size of the dome and the chamber they're in, but they're going to start to deplete the oxygen levels in there, and they're probably going to start to raise the CO2 levels by the expired air. So it was a kind of situation where oxygen levels are dropping, CO2 levels are rising, they're undernourished, they're dehydrated. It's absolutely astonishing that they were located in relatively good conditions. And certainly there's other things involved in the caves, you know, epidemiological problems with respect to infections, psychological aspects of being in complete darkness for 9 days until they were discovered, not knowing that rescue was even coming. Terrifying, absolutely terrifying.
Yeah, and that's something we're definitely going to touch on a little bit here. Your thoughts? Anything else you want to add to that?
Bob covered it pretty much. Yeah, I would agree with everything you said. And my biggest thing would be the fact that they had no communication with the outside world, so they had no idea anyone was even looking for them. And then all of a sudden, somebody pops up out of the water, you know, asking them if they're okay. You know, that had to be huge. Because for 9 days in darkness, not being able to see, I don't know. I'm guessing they drank the water that was there. Hopefully, you know, I'm guessing there's going to be some repercussions from that in the weeks to follow. But and that's a true survival situation. You need to do what you need to do. If there's water, you need to drink it and worry about the after effects of whether or not you're going to get sick from it later on. I'm just glad that they were found alive and well, as opposed to the alternative.
And I'd like to touch on with you, Bob, a little bit about why it took 10 days for rescue to reach them. If it only took them maybe a few hours to scamper, you know, and climb and do whatever to get away from the rising waters that far into the cave system, why did it take 10 days to reach them? And I think that this is the, you know, the technical rescue aspect of this in the cave diving sense, that they had to stage and do lots of little hops to get to where they were. Is that correct?
It is. That's my understanding of it as well. I can say that keep in mind that when they originally entered the cave was mostly, if not completely, dry. So traversing the cave was not all that challenging for the most part. You know, to go in 2.5 miles, I was surprised when I first heard that distance. So, you know, it takes a certain amount of energy and everything else to get that far, even in a dry cave, of course. But then when it comes to the rescue, the first part that was amazing is that they even discovered anyone who was in there. And my limited understanding of how that occurred is that they just had a whole bunch of bicycles parked at the entrance of the cave. And after a few days, people started saying, like, well, why are these bicycles here? And they kind of put two and two together and figured out that someone may have gone into this cave. And then they noticed that the cave was at least partially flooded. And so I don't know that they were even convinced or positive. They had no way to really know that the people were even in the cave at that point. So I think they made an educated guess, and they ventured into the cave. And after going in who knows how far, they discovered that, well, wait a minute, now it's partially flooded. So if we want to pursue the exploration of this cave in the hopes that the people are back there, we're going to have to get some cave divers in here to do that. And you have the complexity of a cave dive itself, which is certainly a great undertaking under the best of conditions. And now you also have to drag all your dive equipment back through this cave to where the flooded part begins. And the part that was flooded is known in cave diving as a sump, which is just an area of a cave that is a low point that is filled with water, and the only way to traverse it is through dive gear. So they had to do that, traverse the first sump, and then what appeared, they had more dry areas that they then had to drag their equipment through and go through yet another sump. And I think there were two or possibly three sumps that they had to traverse. I don't think the underwater portion was very, let's say, long, and I don't think it was very deep with respect to actual water depth, but just the fact that you have to drag all this gear into the cave, make the dive, get out of the sump, drag it again, get back in there, and still really not knowing what your goal is here. You're going to push as far as you can for as long as you can, air permitting, and just the fitness of the divers certainly is in question. They're really going to struggle very hard. So you put all that together, and it seems like that's you can kind of get a feel for the Herculean effort involved in getting that far back. And it was just, can you imagine? I mean, for a moment, if they had just stopped a little bit short of that chamber where those people were held up, then they would still be there without even knowing for sure that they were back there. So a lot of things came together. The stars really lined up as far as figuring out the people were in the cave and then actually locating them. And then, again, as I alluded to, all the effort involved in just moving all that gear and just it's my hat is off to those people. They really did an extraordinary effort.
And the other thing that I was thinking about is how they're going to calculate how much air they're going to need. So how many bottles had to be hauled in? Because a bottle of air is a finite resource, and under a heavy load, you can blow through a bottle of air in, what, Bob, about 15 minutes?
So well, you know, a lot depends on how deep you're going to go and what your breathing rate is. It's hard to estimate what size your tanks are. There's a lot of variables involved with that. But you know, certainly, they don't know how far they have to push in the underwater section of the cave. So at some point, they're going to be governed by their gas amounts, and they're going to have to monitor their gauges and say, well, there's a certain point. In cave diving, we generally follow a rule of thirds, and what that is you use one-third of your gas supply for your push forward into the cave. You use the second third for your return. And so when you're done, you should have one third left, and that's in case of an emergency. So you're governed by those limiting factors. And I'm sure they made a couple of attempts to figure out, you know, exactly how far we can go on a given volume of gas. And they made some good calculations, and here we are talking about it now. And it really had a very happy ending.
Well, it says something for the resiliency of youth. And I have a specific question about saying right now, Bob, but I want to jump to Joe. Looking at this, Joe, from your rescue expertise, what are you thinking?
Well, I think everybody's really covered the challenges here quite nicely. It is a phenomenally complex operation, just from the logistics standpoint. You know, complicated by the fact that it's, you know, underwater in the dark, et cetera. And then, you know, at the end of all that, there's still a rescue to be done with, you know, 15 people that have barely know how to swim. And so just the layers of complexity in this entire operation are mind-boggling almost. So I'm not sure how much more you can add to it. How much harder does this need to be?
Yeah, you know, it's something to keep in mind as well when we talk about, you know, the difficulties involved in this and the dangers and the effort involved. You know, we shouldn't lose sight of the fact that a highly trained diver died in his effort to rescue these people. So it adds to the tragedy and the complexity of what this is. It makes you appreciate what was actually involved in this.
So, Bob, do you have a sense of what happened to him? I haven't seen much detail.
I was kind of digging into that myself because a lot of the news reports that I heard were very unclear. They used to refer to, or I've heard several of them refer to, he died of a lack of oxygen, which doesn't answer a lot of questions. I mean, was that diving? Was it in the dome and the oxygen levels dropped? So it was very unclear, and it wasn't really until just a short time ago in an article there was a reference to the fact that this person apparently ran out of air on the way out of the cave during a submerged portion of this while he was diving. Now, as tragic as that is, I haven't independently confirmed it. It probably makes the most sense, but just a very sad situation. His guy involved volunteering basically in a rescue like this, and he ends up dying. And I mean, it happens. Cave diving is probably the most dangerous aspect of scuba diving you can involve yourself in, and this just is a prime example of what can happen.
Yeah, and this guy is an experienced diver. I mean, he's a tantamount to a Navy SEAL, so something, you know, could have been equipment malfunction, who knows. Jamie, you had another question, didn't you?
Well, I was just wanting to kind of touch base with Joe about some of the medical aspects of this rescue, because, I mean, there were the technical aspects involved with the diving. But you also had people that were inexperienced as divers, not good swimmers or unable to swim, and were also malnourished, oxygen depleted, potentially having other infections from the cave around them for being in there for so long. What kind of, as a doctor, you know, involved with this rescue, what are some of the things you're thinking about on how you get them out? What do you have to be worried about at each stage along the way to check to make sure they're ready for the next part of the dive? What are some of the things you keep in mind in that situation?
Well, I think we've sort of hinted at some of that stuff already. Certainly the most immediate concern in that situation, as Bob referenced earlier, is what's the O2 and the CO2 level in that confined space that they're in, and the need to correct that situation as quickly as you can. So, you know, their oxygen levels are gradually going down. Their CO2 levels are gradually rising to the point that they, don't think clearly, don't make good decisions, and subsequently just sort of go to sleep, and that's the end. So, you know, that's the first piece of that. And then once you've corrected that sort of immediate situation, then it's on to the other stuff that you were referring to. You know, they're malnourished. They're obviously frightened. That they may have, you know, infections, other, you know, waterborne illnesses, all sorts of stuff that you would need to assess them for and try to make a reasonable assessment in a very challenging situation as to the ability of these young people to be able to handle the stresses of that situation, whether that's physically or mentally or both. You want to get them out as quickly as you can, but you don't want to go too fast. And so it sounds like they addressed that very clearly with, you know, several days of preparation and some education and, you know, hydrating them up, getting them fed, you know, just taking care of sort of the basics to get a sense of where they were. So, you know, I think that's kind of the first part of that is we've got to get out of here, especially with the time pressures of impending additional monsoon rains and all of that stuff that was coming. So I cannot imagine the pressure that team was under of needing to move versus making sure they're ready to move. They clearly made the right decision in how they manage that situation. And now we'll just have to sort of see what the longer term issues are related to infectious diseases, psychological issues that we talked about, et cetera. And we can get to all that stuff later on.
Yeah, I do have some specific questions, Joe. Well, the movie will probably be out by Christmas, so we'll get more information on what actually happened in there. But I want to throw it out to Kyle. I'm sure you got a lot of things rolling through your mind.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just hearing the perspective both from the technical rescue side as well as from the medical side. Both are really intriguing to me and how it all kind of revolves around a weather event that ultimately kind of precipitated a lot of this, and no pun intended, poor choice of words. Anyway, with the monsoon season starting up, you know, in Thailand, that's very, very common to get these big, you know, bursts of rain over very isolated areas because you have an abundant source of moisture and then it comes on shore. Just think about all my friends in the coastal areas. You get your sea breezes that bring lines of thunderstorms over the land in the afternoon. And think about if that sea breeze moves just even half a mile or half a kilometer one way or another, that's the difference between you getting, say, 16 or 20 inches of rain, perhaps, from a crazy downpour, or that downpour occurring just offshore and it doesn't affect anyone except those that are out in boats. So it can be that hyper-local, and unfortunately it was a cascade of effects that ultimately led to this, but I'm sure there's going to be a lot of great lessons learned from this. And I think the really big takeaway for me was just how you had communities and experts from around the world come together to effect a positive outcome and rescue for all those that were trapped. And I think that is the thing that amazes me the most, is that how we can still all come together, put our differences aside to save others.
Yeah, you're right, Kyle. I saw something that said there was about 100 people involved at some level with the rescue effort, to the extent that the prime minister going to host a banquet to thank the foreign divers. And in fact, it was two British divers that finally were able to get in there. But I wanted to ask Bob about this. There's a tech billionaire named Elon Musk who had a mini sub made out of rocket parts that he offered up, that they didn't using it. They felt it was kind of impractical for the rescue mission. What do you know about that? Anything?
You know, I tell you, Elon Musk is a fascinating individual. My hat is off to him. He's made accomplishments in life that any one of which would be extraordinary. He's done, let's see, I think he was instrumental in creating PayPal. He started a Tesla car company. Now he has SpaceX. The guy's amazing. But when I first heard about that micro submarine of his, I said, wow, what a really cool technology in certain situations. But I pretty much realized that for this situation that we're talking about here, it would be impractical only because of size. If you're trying to get through, like I said, a 15-inch restriction, you're not going to get a submarine to go through there, let alone the size. And there was also some bends that occurred in these tunnels that they were navigating on the water. So you put together the bends and just the size of the diameter of the tunnel itself. And although it was a great gesture, I don't think it was a very practical thing to use here. It wasn't appropriate.
Somehow I can see Kevin wanting to play with one of those. Maybe when someday you'll get your chance, Kevin.
Really. We'll see.
Joe, some specific questions on all of the different medical potential here. They said that two of these kids ended up with lung infections to the extent that they can't, there's a place for their parents to see them, but they can't actually touch them for 2 days. You want to talk a little about what that might be? Then is it contagious? What is it?
Well, so that's a really good question, and I know, you know, what I've seen on the news media, which is not much. You know, I think that the things that you would worry about in that environment are, you know, a damp, dark, moist environment over obviously 10 days here for these kids. And you think of things like, you know, fungi and spores and not your sort of typical infectious disease related things. I don't know if there were, if this cave was at significant periods of the year not a not flooded. In other words, could animals, you know, make it as far in as the people did? I would assume that they can. Then you have to worry about things like, are there bats nesting in there? You know, is there guano in there? You know, concerns over all manner of infectious diseases that rodents or cave dwelling animals might could carry. So, you know, I have to assume that the reason that these kids are sort of being held in some kind of quarantine is looking out for the possibilities of some of these infectious disease related issues. Whether or not they're really contagious or not, I don't know. The biggest one I could think of that might be concerning would be something like rabies or something like that. But you know, it may be done just so that it's easier to figure out more quickly what the affecting agent is and not have these kids be exposed to, you know, their parents and catch a cold from their parent and then try to figure out, is that related to him being in this cave? And do we need to be treating him for some bizarre, you know, fungal infection when in reality they got a little virus and they don't need anything? So part of this may be just an effort to sort of keep the number of possibilities fairly limited and a period of observation to ensure that illnesses that may take some time before they begin to develop symptoms have a chance to declare themselves.
And I heard that there were possibilities that they were quarantining them as well, potentially because their own immune systems might be compromised. And they didn't want them catching anything to complicate on top of what they already had going on. So that may be part of the case I had heard described once on more than one occasion as well. So go ahead, Sam.
It's interesting that you say that, Jamie, because one of the comments I saw was, quote, these kids are footballers, so they have high immune system.
Well, but they're also malnourished and low oxygen levels and all those other things that are going to affect the body systems to the point that some things could be compromised. I think the medical staff is probably being super cautious, taking extra precautions just to make sure that they didn't come out and then get some hospital-borne infection that they just happened to encounter because they had a decreased immune system. So my guess is it was precautionary.
So Kevin, you're making some good points on the side that we missed. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, that's fine. I was going to say exactly the same thing, Sam. You know, Kevin brought up a couple of points that I didn't mention, and that's related to potentially waterborne infections of all sorts, from parasites and all kinds of stuff in the water that they were obviously forced to drink. And then concerns of significant disease processes that may be related to the mixing of human waste and the water that, again, they're being forced to drink. So they're literally living in their own toilet. So, you know, I think that goes a bit to Jamie's point. And it also, again, increases the spectrum of diseases that they would have to be concerned about as to whether they have some, you know, fluke or, you know, gastrointestinal worm or who knows what that might be living in there in that water that they've ingested. And now 10 days in, they're beginning to get symptomatic from that.
Yeah, they're going to have to monitor them for quite a while. Bob, what was the temperature in there? Was hypothermia a potential problem, or was it hypothermia? What was that condition like, you know?
Temperatures in caves tend to be fairly constant, but it certainly is, you know, I know from diving in the tropics, everybody says, you know, gee, you're diving in like 85 degree water. How could you ever get cold? And you think to yourself, well, if your body temperature is approximately 98 degrees, so you're that much colder. And the same thing in a cave, even though the temperatures are fairly constant, and I would have to think somewhere, not being familiar with that particular system and the environment, I think you're somewhere in the 70 degree range. But that's considerably less than your body temperature. And they didn't go in there with the intention of being in there for any length of time. And they were, from the pictures I saw, they're sitting in there with their shorts and T-shirts. So if anything, I think hypothermia would be a consideration. One of the things I also saw after the rescue was underway is that they provided the kids, at least some of them, with what's known as space blankets, which is kind of really just a Mylar cloth that reflects your own body heat back when you wrap yourself in it. So I have to assume that some of them were cold, at least on some level, because of the air temperature itself, not to mention that they're in a very damp environment. So I would think hypothermia would be the biggest concern with respect to temperature that they were experiencing in the cave.
Well, Bob, one thing that we didn't cover too well, and here's a comment I saw about it. The boys wore diving masks that covered their whole face. One diver was in front holding an oxygen tank for the boy, and another diver was behind ensuring the safety of the boy. Were they actually using oxygen? Were they using scuba?
I think it's unlikely they were using pure oxygen. If I had to guess, and again, I don't know this for certain, but I think just mostly for logistical considerations, I think they were probably just breathing air. I had mentioned earlier there's another type of gas called enriched air nitrox with higher oxygen levels than what you experience in air. But I think it's unlikely they would even use that, only because of the logistics involved. And again, it appeared that the submerged parts of the cave that they had to swim through were not deep with respect to, you know, the actual depth of the water. So that narcosis I spoke of earlier and things of that nature would really not be a concern. So if I had to make a guess, I think they were just probably breathing just air. With the full face mask that you spoke of, that was a great idea. I think they went in the right direction completely on that. Again, because you're dealing with kids that have little to no swim skills, none of them had any diving skills, and let alone any kind of specific cave training. And cave training is extensive. It takes a lot to dive in a cave, a lot of training and a lot of experience to consider yourself a decent cave diver. And these kids, through no fault of their own, they just had none of these things. So the biggest concern that I think people would have with this is their comfort level in water, which is going to be limited considering they didn't even swim. And the biggest overriding concern is that if they do put them in the water, that they panic. And if you panic, pretty much all is lost at that point. Now, the advantage, I bring that up because the advantage of using a full face mask, which is what they were apparently using here, is that in a panic situation, it's common that divers on more standard scuba could spit out their regulator and tear off their mask just in a fit of panic. And with a full-face mask, you really can't, I mean, you could in theory rip off the mask, but I think they were being very controlled by the other two divers, and unlikely that would occur. But they can't spit out the regulator because it's an integral part of that mask that they had on. And it covers the entire face, and it's a much more controlled way of taking these kids out, and it reduces the possibility of them spitting out a regulator and things of that nature. Another thing that you can find in full-face masks, and I don't know that they employed it in this situation, but full-face masks can be fitted with communication gear. So they could actually communicate by voice with these boys if they were so equipped. Now, I don't know that they were, but that is something that they could have. Whether they used it or not, I'm not really sure.
Oh, good point. Joe, you made some comments. Can you talk about what you threw in the sidebar there?
Well, we were, you know, as we kind of go on and on about the medical and psychological and physiological aspects of all this, you know, my brain's kind of turning on the fact that these kids have been in complete darkness for 10 days and the challenges of adapting their vision back to light is going to take some period of time. You know, a few days is probably enough there to restore that some, but obviously it's pretty dim lights and there's some challenges there. And then, you know, the effects on the immune system of a lack of, sunshine in a very generic kind of way, meaning, you know, vitamin D levels will be low. Their cortisol levels will be all jacked up because their sleep-wake cycles are going to be disrupted. There's no external reference as to, you know, it's time to go to sleep now and time to wake up now. So, and experience has shown over some experiments over past years that, you know, if people are removed from all external relevance to time, they tend to stretch out. You know, I mean, you might be awake for 24 hours and then sleep for 12 hours and then be awake for 24. So, you know, those natural rhythms that are not influenced by sunshine and, you know, a watch and things like that suddenly start getting all out of whack. And I think those can have substantial impacts on immune system function, as well as just mental processing power and all the stuff that Bob was just talking about in concerns of, you know, panic and not understanding what they're trying to do and having challenges following directions, even when they're trying to be shepherded out of there.
What about hypernatremia, Joe? We were talking about them drinking the salt water. What's the long-term effects, should that have been the case?
Well, I don't know that my assumption on this cave would be that this is mostly fresh water. That doesn't mean that, you know, salt content couldn't be off a little bit. They certainly could have some electrolyte abnormalities based on sort of a starvation diet and, you know, questionable water. But hypernatremia, although possible, I would think most of that's going to be freshwater stuff and therefore not likely to be too much of a problem. You're certainly not going to last 10 days drinking seawater. And, you know, you're going to have a huge amount of electrolyte issues if you're drinking true salt water exclusively.
Kyle, you made a good point. You want to talk about that?
Sure, Sam. So with this particular event, what really caused the primary rush of water into that cave system that trapped the boys in the cave was it was rainwater that fell. So it fell as fresh water, picked up probably a few contaminants on its way as it flowed through. And then once it got down into the cave system, it mixed with whatever groundwater that was already there just in the cave. So it kind of probably diluted itself quite effectively because it was quite the deluge of water that came rushing down in there.
Good point. Always good to have a weather guy reflect on those specific things. So a question I'll ask a bunch of you. Bob, what do you think of in terms of PTSD down the line for these kids? I mean, as much as they say, yeah, they were happy, and it sounded like a best-case scenario, but, you know, there was a lot going on and a lot still to go on. And, of course, the reaction of their parents. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I tell you, I had mentioned this earlier, that for the 9 days that they were down there, and they totally lost track of time, I'm sure, they didn't know they were going to be rescued. So I can imagine, until those two British divers popped up in the water, and I can't imagine how euphoric they were on that. But up to that point, they weren't sure they were going to be rescued. So I can only imagine their stress levels were off the charts. Who knows how that's going to affect them down the road? You have to assume that that they will be monitored, you know, for psychological problems for quite a while. These issues tend to manifest themselves a little bit down the road. They may not be readily apparent right away, but I certainly would think they will be monitored for quite a while. Like I said, the stress level of not knowing you're going to be rescued, and then to go through the actual rescue process itself with, you know, the whole diving aspect. It's an environment you're not familiar with. And cave diving is extremely intimidating, even to a very experienced diver. So I think that's something that they're going to have to be monitored for quite a while.
Kevin, you made a good point on this. You want to mention that?
Well, I think the fact that there were 13 people together had to help with their mental... their overall mental well-being played a certain amount of benefit, you know, especially the fact that there was an adult there trying to keep the boy's spirits up, talking about, you know, hey, the water should be, you know, going away, you know, soon, or just trying to do, I mean, he was a coach. So I'm thinking he was doing everything he could to keep everyone's spirits up, encouraging to tell stories and just have a good time to keep their mind off of, you know, the potential impending doom. But I'm sure that played a pretty good part in keeping all the spirits up. And because when I saw the video of from the divers who had a camera on when they first popped up, everyone looked like, you know, obviously that they were very happy, but I didn't see, you know, from the video wasn't the greatest in the world, but it didn't appear that everyone was, you know, on the verge of just giving up. They looked to be in pretty good spirits.
Well, it was an interesting factoid, too, that I just got very recently, that a lot of these kids were refugees from Myanmar, and one of them was a multilingual. One of the kids became an interpreter. So there was a bit of a language thing going on there, too, but having that one kid there probably made a big difference in their ability to communicate with each other. I found that kind of fascinating. Joe, what are your thoughts on the PTSD issue?
Well, I think we've touched on a lot of different aspects of it. You know, certainly kudos to the coach for a pretty amazing job of keeping that whole situation under control. I'm like you. I've only seen the one video of the diver and the kids themselves, and they did indeed look pretty good. And it's certainly possible that they had no idea it had been 8 or 9 days. You know, they thought it had been a couple. I think the stress level on those kids had to have been tremendous. I think there's no question that certainly in the short and medium term, there's going to be some depression and anxiety, et cetera, related to all that. They certainly may have trouble down the road with, you know, being uncomfortable in the dark and in tight spaces and, you know, who knows what else. But I think it, as the healing process goes on and time passes, they'll certainly begin to appreciate the amazing resilience that they demonstrated in being able to get themselves out of that situation with the help of a whole bunch of amazing folks that were there to take care of business.
Oh, absolutely. Any final thoughts, Kyle, from you? You've been listening there.
Yeah, Sam. Just to kind of how I'm kind of going through and processing this whole, not just the podcast, but all the wealth of information that's been out there. It kind of brings me back to the 2010 mining disaster in Chile. You know, the 33. It may ring a bell for some of you there. And you know, you had 33 miners trapped and for, you know, tens of days. I can't remember exactly how long, but it was several months they were down there. Thankfully, this situation wasn't as dire. But again, it just shows that when there's a need that folks can come together and, you know, it starts local. But you ask for help and you're going to get it. And another thing, too, and that I'm glad that we touched on it here at the end, is the mental health aspect of it. And not just for, you know, for the kids and the coach, but for the responders as well, because this is probably something that there wasn't a book for it. There was not this is a step-by-step guide. So we're going to learn a lot from it, but it also may take a while for folks to recover and process the events mentally for it as well. And that's something that we have to consider for our day-to-day operations even as well.
Good point. Joe, final thoughts?
Yeah, I just was, as Kyle was making that comment there, it sort of hit me that, you know, the people that were participating in this rescue were literally on the world stage, pulling off an incredibly complicated rescue where there were 10,000 opportunities for things to go wrong and, you know, very few for them all to go right. And the fact that, you know, they got all these kids out successfully is a monumental amount of credit for the professionalism, the knowledge, and the dedication of those folks who were involved in this rescue. It just off the charts.
Oh, I agree. Excellent story. And I know there's a book being written even as we speak. Bob, you've been an awesome guest as we wind down here. What are your final thoughts on this? What are your takeaways from it as a diver?
Well, you know, it is amazing. I mean, a lot of the people that were involved in this were professional cave diving rescue people. They do this type of thing. And as I think Kyle alluded to, there is no real book on this one. This was a pretty unique situation. Usually when, you know, when a dive rescue team is going in to rescue someone inside of a cave diving situation, they're rescuing other divers. But in this case, these weren't trained people. These were just, you know, kids. So it's a really unique situation, and they were writing the book as they went along. So I mean, this was an astonishing effort by a lot of really good people, and it's just a wonderful story. It had such a great ending.
Well, maybe you and Kevin need to write that book. Final thoughts, Kevin?
I'm just curious, and the different methods that were considered prior to settling on going in with scuba. I know that there had to be umpteen million different thoughts about how to best proceed, how to get them out without resorting to taking them out underwater. So I'm kind of interested to see what the original thoughts were, what the game plans were before they finally decided on the avenue that they actually went with, and all of the resources that were needed to pull it off. Because this was phenomenal. There had to be, you know, I've thought about and I've read about and talked to people about what their thoughts were from, you know, why couldn't they drill a hole? Why couldn't they just, you know, dig up and breach the, you know, since they knew where they were, why couldn't they just drill down and get them up that way? So there's a lot of things that went into it. And that's kind of what I'm interested to hear about, you know, what was planned and what was scrapped. And the reasons why, because it had
to
be.
Joe, you know, you're the guy that does these kinds of operations. Can you imagine leading?
I can imagine there not being enough brown whiskey on the planet to be comfortable in that environment, trying to plan that. You know, I mean, this is ICS 10,000. multiple countries involved, lots of experts in their field, all of whom are brilliant, but I'm sure not all agree on the right path. And, you know, trying to manage phenomenal resources, and as we've already said, in a situation where there is no book, so we're just going to make this up as we go. So, again, it just mind-boggling the complexities that were involved in this rescue, and the fact that this came out in such a phenomenal manner, apart from the loss of this one diver, it is just absolutely breathtaking.
Yeah, and I'm sure we'll be hearing more in the future on, you know, how the guys are doing and, you know, all of the things that could have been done, all of the things, you know, there'll be a woulda, coulda, shoulda going on there. But like you said, it ended well. It ended, just the fact that they were found was amazing. And you can imagine how they felt knowing somebody was actually there to rescue them. The details of that weren't as important as, yeah, they're going to get us out of here. So I don't know.
I can't imagine there's anybody on the planet that's going to be able to criticize the way this operation went.
My God.
Nobody's ever done that before. So, you know, if you got some criticism, man, I you know, go away.
Yeah.
Just seriously.
Yeah. Well, a lot of people don't understand, as we do, what it's like to be a rescuer and have to come up with a solution for a very complicated process. So, Jamie, I don't know about you, but I probably learned more on this podcast than any we've ever done.
Well, and it brings to mind a lot of just all the lessons we've talked about over the last, you know, 5 years on this show of being resilient, being flexible. This takes all of that to, as Joe said, to the level of 10,000 beyond what we ever have discussed before. And I think that this is one of the things that we can take away from this. I mean, I'm really looking forward to the after action report that comes out of this, because this is going to be one of those things that I think is going to be studied by professional rescuers and technical rescue teams for years to come. I heard one person on the news say this was akin to Apollo 13, but on a terrestrial basis, that all of these experts came together and said, we've got to solve this problem. And here's the set of resources we have. Here's the set of problems we have. What are the potential solutions? And as has been alluded to, there were probably multiple solutions, and there were probably disagreements about what the best options were. And yet the outcome came out pretty much as good as it could be expected. And we lost that diver, which is tragic, but at the end of the day, we got the kids out and the coach out, and everything in the actual rescue operation, when it was put in place, worked. And this is something I want to kind of come around with Joe as we wrap up. You know, we talk because Paragon Medical Education Group is our sponsor, and Joe, you represent them here on the show. You guys bring your experiential training that you do for disaster planning and disaster training to different jurisdictions. How does that flexibility get brought into the training you do?
Well, I think, you know, a realization that situations like this at some level are exactly what you face in disaster. And therefore, you know, how do you handle adversity and the fact that there is no book on how to do this, and that this one is different, as they all are. We've talked about that a lot in many, many different ways. So, you know, from my perspective, I want the after action report on this thing so bad, because it will be absolutely fascinating reading and incredibly insightful and enlightening. And I think there are many, many lessons to learn here.
So for folks,
benefit from this, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jamie.
And for folks that want to find out, you know, just to kind of pick your brain and maybe talk about this, maybe talk about how they have caves in their region. How do you get together with you, and maybe you bring in your experts to talk about different types of rescues they might want to approach with a situation in their system or whatever? How can they contact you? How can they find out exactly what you can provide for them?
Well, we'd absolutely love to talk to them so that we can customize that experience to be whatever it is they want it to be and however unique they'd like to make it. So they can reach us over the web at ParagonMedicalGroup.com. We have a Facebook page, Paragon Medical Group, as well. And they can always get in touch with us through the Disaster Podcast team.
And we thank you again for your continued support of the show. We really appreciate it. Bob, you know, we'd like to give you an opportunity to talk about your services and what you do. Is there a place where people can find out more about what you do and the training and things you offer?
Yeah, there sure is. My company is called Ocean Services Dive and Marine Consulting. There's a website of osdmc.com, and there's also a link to a Facebook page, which has a lot of the current things I'm involved with. And it lists all the services that we provide. And I would encourage people to take a look, and I'd be glad to answer any questions they may have and help them out in any way that I can.
Fantastic. And I'll make sure we have links to that in our show notes for this episode so people will be able to find you.
Great. I appreciate that very much.
Oh, no. Thank you very much for making yourself available for our chat here this evening. We really appreciate it.
You're very welcome. Appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, it was great. Kevin, how about you? Where can folks find you?
People can find me in the usual places. They can find me on the web at wildsafety.com, and I have links to all the social media on the website. And there's a Facebook page and a Facebook group, the Wilderness Safety Institute, if you're on Facebook. And I'm on Twitter and all that other fun stuff, and always here on the Disaster Podcast.
Excellent. And Kyle, how about you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all the social medias under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. I'm always happy to connect and continue the conversation about weather or preparedness.
And as we wrap up things here, Sam, folks want to reach out to you. Where can they find you?
In the usual social media places under Sam Bradley, Sam Bradley 11. In our Facebook group, which I hope we can coerce Bob into joining, because I'm sure there'll be a lot of questions about this, and on the disasterpodcast.com website. How about you, Jamie?
You can find me under all the social media channels out there under the handle PodMedic, and it's great to be able to connect with folks. So please, if you find me, a friend, follow, or otherwise catch up with me there. Love to get in touch with folks, all my listeners for my various podcasts. It's always great to connect with you, so please reach out to me. And of course, find us over at our Disaster Podcast Facebook group. Just search for Disaster Podcast and request to join the group over there. And we'd love to have you in there. We'll go ahead and approve you. It's no secret thing. It's just how Facebook sets up their groups. So we have to have approval process, but it's just basically make a request and we'll let you in. We've had quite an animated discussion on a variety of topics and links related to this rescue over there. We'll have this episode linked over there as well. And I'll also make sure I post the link there as well to Bob's Facebook page as well, so you guys can check in with what he's got going on. This has been a fascinating episode, Sam. And, you know, we've talked about disaster medicine. I don't think we've ever talked about quite such a complicated disaster medicine profile as what these kids were facing as they were being brought out of the caves.
Oh, exactly. And we just kept thinking of more and more things, and I'm sure there's many that we haven't thought of that will appear in the future. But I was thinking of actually changing the tagline. Disaster rescue is not our everyday rescue.